From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh about the secret understanding between Pakistan and the U.S. to secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons and prevent them from getting into the hands of jihadists. The Pakistani military denies that such an understanding exists, and so does the U.S. State Department. Hersh writes about Pakistan's nuclear arsenal in the current edition of The New Yorker. We'll also get his reactions to reports that President Obama has rejected the military options for Afghanistan presented by his national security team and is looking for an exit strategy. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Fantastic Mr. Fox, directed by Wes Anderson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. In the current edition of The New Yorker, he reports that the U.S. has a secret understanding with Pakistan that would allow specially trained American units to provide added security for the Pakistani nuclear arsenal in case of crisis. Before we get to that story and its implications, we're going to get his reaction to the story that broke late yesterday that President Obama has rejected the options for Afghanistan presented by his national security team and instead is pushing for revisions to clarify how and when U.S. troops would turn over responsibility to the Afghan government. This follows leaked classified cables from America's ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, expressing his misgivings about sending in more troops. Seymour Hersh won a National Magazine Award for Public Interest for his New Yorker articles on intelligence and the Iraq War. He broke much of the Abu Ghraib story and won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1969 reports on the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Seymour Hersh, welcome back to Fresh Air. Yesterday, after President Obama's meeting with his War Council, the president sent back his national security team asking for an exit strategy, basically. And the White House released a statement saying the president believes we need to make clear to the Afghan government that our commitment is not open-ended. After years of substantial investments by the American people, governance in Afghanistan must improve in a reasonable period of time. What do you think the significance of this is?
Assuming that everything you said is accurate and it's very early in the process, this could be an amazing and a really important step for the president, because I can tell you that many in your audience and obviously many here in Washington are very concerned about the fact that he delegated so much of the war-making policy to the generals in the field, asking General McChrystal, for example, to write the initial report on what to do in Afghanistan. There isn't a general in the armed forces asked to do that would say, I can't win. That's just what they do. So he put himself into a box, and he was very passive for a long time about it. And that's why if you had asked me 4 days ago what I thought, I would have thought he's going to make a political decision to do something, some token troops, because he doesn't want to lose more independence. He wants to show he can run a war. He can be a tough guy. But what Obama's done, if he has done what it seems he's done, is if he's telling the military, you know what, I don't think it's going to fly. This is huge because he's basically saying, I'm not going to play politics with the war. I'm not going to do what other presidents have and continue a war and continue fighting a war and that I don't think we can win, and just stalling for time until I can find a way out. That's what I would have guessed 3 or 4 days ago he was going to do. He was just going to wait for the political moment when the public was so discouraged about the war you could actually end it in some way. Instead, he's saying, I'm going to stand up and be president and take my chances in 2012 on reelection. He's really doing, if he's doing what's been reported, a pretty noble thing. The problem is, and this is a daunting problem, the problem is I don't think there's any way you can stand up the Afghan army. The army traditionally has been controlled by Tajiks and people from Uzbekistan, from those Northern Alliance, we call them, in Afghanistan. The Pashtuns, who would be controlled by this army, theoretically, under the American dream, there's no way they're going to view a Uzbeki or they're going to view him as much of an outsider as they would view the Americans. They simply don't like others in their face.
Last week, the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, General Carl Eikenberry, who served as the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan from 2005 to 2007, he sent a cable to Obama that was leaked yesterday. And in that cable, he expressed reservations about sending more troops to Afghanistan and said basically that unless President Karzai shapes up, our efforts can't be effective. And he's concerned that if we send more troops now, it will just increase Afghanistan's dependence on the United States instead of focusing on strengthening Afghanistan's own security forces. What do you think the significance of that cable is?
Well, that's a terrifically important cable. Eikenberry is a member of the he's on the team. He's always been on the team. He was a classmate. He was a few years ahead.
On which team?
Well, he's on the team of Petraeus and McChrystal. He's always been considered one of the West Point boys. He went to West Point at the same time as Odierno and McChrystal and General Petraeus, who's the commander of the region. And Rodriguez is the general deputy to McChrystal. They're all from the class of 74 and 75. at West Point. And there's been an enormous disarray inside the Army about this small clique of people who always embraced Eikenberry, who went was a few years ahead of them in at West Point. For Eikenberry to break off now and say to the pacification boys, to the counterinsurgency gang led by Petraeus and McChrystal, it ain't going to work. We don't have a government to work on. You can't have counterinsurgency unless you have a viable government. It's an enormous breach, and I'm sure that it's seen as a betrayal by Petraeus, etc. This is a blow to those who want to continue the war in Afghanistan.
Over the past few months, what have you been hearing from your sources in the Pentagon about the McChrystal proposal to send 40,000 more troops?
Well, it's caused an enormous problem inside the Army, at the highest level of the Army. The chief of staff of the Army is a general named George Casey, who ran the war in Iraq for a little while. And Casey and the leadership, the guys who are the point men in the Army, are very skeptical of McChrystal going public, of the publicity campaign that's been going on, and also this drumbeat of 40,000, 60,000 more troops. They don't have them. The men coming back from Iraq are going to be retailed back into Afghanistan. That's not going to be popular. They're going to be demoralized. They also, most of the people, many of them in Iraq right now, drive tanks and tanks and Stryker Brigade, these vehicles, these tractor vehicles, are useless in Afghanistan. It's sort of a boots-on-the-ground place. It's just not a good fit, and they don't have the body. So they've been, and also I think they've been appalled by this public campaign by a general. McChrystal, pushed by Petraeus, I understand, they're all on the same page. All of which what makes what Eikenberry did in those cables so dramatic and so heroic, if you will, because he's not only turning on his buddies from West Point and his buddies in this whole counterinsurgency business, he's also telling the president, essentially, get out.
Where does General Petraeus stand now on a counterinsurgency effort in Afghanistan? Does he believe that that could succeed?
Oh, yes. He and McChrystal are totally on the same page on this. Mm-hmm. What they've done is they're extrapolating from what happened, they believe happened in Iraq. They believe that the surge, the famous surge about there was so much controversy in 2007 and 2008, that the surge worked, that the additional 20 or 30,000 troops was the key factor, the tipping point, if you will, to use a cliche. And they think they can reproduce that sort of event here, that 30 or 40,000 more troops may be a tipping point here. Of course, it's a totally different condition. And it's also not clear that the surge had nearly as much impact as people want to make it out to have had. But that's yesterday's story. But there's just no question. It's a different war, different situation, different terrain. It's still a policy that is being avidly pursued, I would say, by it's the last throw of the Bush-Cheney crowd, really, in a sense, in terms of continuing the war against the caliphate.
What do you think the Obama administration needs to do in Afghanistan?
Well, in my personal opinion is, you start talking to the Taliban. There are many factions in the Taliban. Many of them are warlords, local warlords. You cut a local deal, and there you are. You get out of there, they're going to stop killing you. And you live up to your commitment to stay out, and they will live up to their commitment to not going after Americans. One of the things they do want is economic help. As I said, they're very, very mercantile. For example, right now they have huge marble, beautiful marble they have in Taliban, as good as anything in Italy. And you know how they mine it? They mine it by blasting it out. They lose 90% of it by dynamiting it out. We could go in with a lot of cash and show them ways to get this marble out and not lose 90% of it and have a profitable industrial base. And one way of getting them off the opium business, the poppy business.
Now, your new article is on Pakistan. Before we talk about the article, what do you think the government of Pakistan, the leadership in Pakistan, would like to see the U.S. do in Afghanistan?
The government of Pakistan is really up in the air. This is a government that's the civilian government headed by Asif Zardari, the widower of Mrs. Bhutto, who was slain, who was assassinated last year or 2 years ago. He's pretty incompetent. He's not popular. He's considered to be a thief. He's at total war with the military leadership headed by General Kiani, the chief of staff there. So you have incredible chaos inside that government. I think basically the pressure we're putting on the Pakistani military to go after their own people, the idea that our problems can be solved if we somehow attack the Pakistani Taliban and overcome them, which is a really daunting task. I think that's misguided. My own impression is they would be delighted if we backed off that pressure and they could just go back to hating India and let it go. They hate India, India hates them, and they build up the armies against, they all think and dream of each other. The notion that we have to go after, that we have to expand the war in Afghanistan into Pakistan is a uniquely American notion. And the use of predators, all of this has put enormous strain on the civilian and military leadership, because internally inside the country there's a lot of dissatisfaction and upset about it, and particularly since many people in Pakistan, there's 170 million or a few more than that, there's a large percentage of the population thinks that the government, both the military and the civilians, are too much dominated by America. And so we've added to that, which increases all of the pressure in terms of our interfering, for example, with nuclear weapons, as I've been writing about. That adds to the dislike of us. So I would think keeping the war in Afghanistan, the Taliban war in Afghanistan there, allowing the Pakistanis to make the various agreements they've been making over the years with the Taliban in Pakistan, very unsatisfactory, but it seems to have worked. And I don't know why we want to start tinkering with something that worked. Just as you could argue, are we better off if we'd had Saddam in control of Iraq, or is Iraq better off because of the American intervention? I don't think anybody would say Iraq is better off now because we went in. And so it's all very bad. The choices are very bad on all sides. But it seems that our intervention in Iraq and in Pakistan and in Afghanistan does us no good. And so one can argue the faster we figure out a way out of all those places, and this is the daunting task facing Obama, without disgrace and without making it worse for ourselves, is it's better.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. He has an article in the current edition of The New Yorker called Defending the Arsenal. In an unstable Pakistan, can nuclear warheads be kept safe? We'll talk about that article after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. In the current edition of The New Yorker, he reports that the U.S. has been negotiating a secret understanding with the Pakistani military to secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons in case of crisis, to prevent them from getting in the hands of jihadists or terrorists. This understanding would allow specially trained American units to provide added security in case of crisis. The Pakistani Foreign Ministry and the U.S. State Department have denied that there is any such agreement. Hersh's article is called Defending the Arsenal. In an Unstable Pakistan, Can Nuclear Warheads Be Kept Safe? Why did you want to investigate the story of Pakistan nuclear arsenal and what, if any, arrangements the United States has made with Pakistan?
It's a good question, because it came off President Obama's news conference in late April, April 29th, precisely. He had a news conference and he was asked a question about the Pakistan nuclear arsenal. And he said, "There, no problem, they're safe." And he said, "We have absolute confidence in it." And I had done a couple of stories earlier after 9/11 for The New Yorker on Pakistan and the nuclear issue. And I knew the opposite to be true. By that I mean, I knew that many people in the American government were worried, awfully worried about the security of the Pakistani nukes, not so much because the army isn't competent, it is, because there's always a sense, and it's maybe it's a misguided sense in America, there's always a sense that jihadists or terrorists could somehow get access to some of these weapons. That's always been a concern, a contingency concern, if you will. And I had written earlier that we have a unit, a special unit that was created late in the Clinton administration in the Pentagon, whose sole function was to train and prepare to go in and grab the bombs if possible. The scenario that everybody worries about is there's a military crisis anyway, and two or three generals and colonels who are Muslims first and military men second, you know, believers in the caliphate, if you will, and there are such people in the Pakistani military, of course, go to a nuclear facility where there are some weapons stored and take it over, pull rank. You've got a general officer saying to the people, we are now in control, and they get control of a facility. At that point, we then are there to help help the Pakistani army fight their way in or whatever needs to be done.
So have there been any attacks that made you especially concerned about the possibility of jihadists getting access to Pakistan's nuclear weapons?
Not really, because Pakistan's a secular country. The army is pretty solid. There certainly is a lot of evidence because of our war and in Afghanistan. There's an increasing pressure on Pakistan, for example, as we see now, to get more aggressive, to start in getting into combat against its own people. There's certainly a great deal of dislike of America, official America, by the Pakistani military and the Pakistani government. I never worried that much about al-Qaeda personally, because I always thought if they got a bomb, they would have to eat it. They wouldn't know what to do with it. Even if they got their hands in some enriched materials, you know, radioactive materials, it would poison them before they could do much with it. The lingering concern always is that we do know that there are many people in the Pakistani military who really believe they're Muslims first and soldiers second, that that is a reality. It's a small percentage, but they're there. And there have been attempted coups in years past, certainly. And don't forget, President Zia, who ran the country 2 decades ago, was a dedicated Islamist. So there's a long tradition of very strong feelings about Islam, and also a long tradition of a great deal of resentment towards America. But what happened in the last month is really interesting, because in the last month, there was an attack on the equivalent of the American Pentagon, the army, Pakistani army headquarters in Rawalpindi, a suburb of Islamabad, the capital, and some jihadists or Pashtuns or terrorists. We really don't know that much about who's doing all the bombings and whether the motivations are political or religious or what you will. But a group of terrorists certainly got inside and shot up things, and clearly that was done with inside help. There was a general targeted.
Inside help from the military who sympathized with.
Yeah, obviously inside. They had to get inside, a fifth column, if you will. They had to get inside, and also they ambushed and assassinated a very a powerful, strong, progressive general, army general, brigadier, they call him in the Pakistani army. Shot on the street, and clearly that was prearranged. They knew where he was going to be. They knew where his car was, what it looked like, and they opened fire. And that does suggest that if there are a group of people inside the military willing to help, if they're willing to set up assassinations and willing to set up even break-ins into the headquarters, the most sacrosanct place probably militarily in all of Pakistan, except for the nuclear facility, why can't they get access to something?
And there is this belief, I think, that since the Pakistani army and its intelligence service are believed to have used jihadist groups to fight India over Kashmir, that there could be people in the Pakistani military who actually sympathize with the jihadists who they've been helping.
Oh, you can make it much stronger than that. There's no question
okay.
that the Pakistani intelligence has been deeply involved with the Taliban of Afghanistan. And also even in supporting al-Qaeda. One of the other things the president said on his April the 29th news conference that absolutely staggered me, he said what had been being said by people like Richard Holbrooke, the czar, if you will, the special advisor for South Asia, and others. Hillary Clinton had even said it, that we really want to get the Pakistanis, we want to wean them away from this overwhelming insecurity about India, and get them more worried about what's going on in their region. We want them more worried about the al-Qaeda and the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, and less worried about India, which is really, I have to tell you, a tone deaf if you think that's possible. And in the Pakistan, in other words, that's the core of their existence in Pakistan is this anti-India fear and resentment and jealousy and the sense, by the way, that we love India more than we love them. And I can tell you that in Pakistan, today even, some of these jihadist groups, and particularly those who work in Kashmir, which is the contested area between India and Pakistan that's been contested since the government, the two countries were formed, when the Raj broke up and the British Empire broke up in 1947, the Pakistani military sees these radical groups, some of the more extreme groups, as a national security force, as a reliable force against the Indians. And the idea that we and the Americans would tell the Pakistanis, you now have to treat these people as enemy. They're Taliban. They're close to Al-Qaeda. Yes, they help you against India. Yes, they help you in Kashmir. There are people there that do terrorist activity for you. But they're no longer, you can't consider them a strategic asset. We have stopped that kind of talk. That talk was pretty dominant in the spring of this year after the President Obama announced his AFPAC, the famous AFPAC policy, extending the war in Afghanistan into Pakistan. And that kind of talk's gone now. We understand that the Pakistanis are always going to be obsessed with India, and India is always going to be obsessed with Pakistan.
Seymour Hersh will be back in the second half of the show. His article in the current edition of The New Yorker is titled "Defending the Arsenal. In an Unstable Pakistan, Can Nuclear Warheads Be Kept Safe?" I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop. From Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. And from DK Eyewitness Travel, publisher of Off the Tourist Trail, 1,000 Unexpected Travel Alternatives, with a foreword by Bill Bryson. This is NPR.
Coming up, why Seymour Hersh broke the story about what he says is a secret understanding between the U.S. and Pakistan about securing Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. And David Edelstein reviews the new animated film The Fantastic Mr. Fox, based on a Roald Dahl book and directed by Wes Anderson. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. In the current edition of The New Yorker, he writes that the U.S. and Pakistan have a secret understanding with the Pakistani military to secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons in case of crisis, to prevent the weapons from getting in the hands of jihadists. This understanding would allow specially trained American units to provide added security if there is a crisis. So let's get to the kind of negotiations that you say the U.S. has had with Pakistan about how to control the nuclear weapons in case they are left in a position that's not secure. You said that this agreement would allow specially trained American units to provide added security for the Pakistani nuclear arsenal in case of a crisis. So what is the plan that you were told the U.S. and Pakistan put into effect?
It's actually the word we used in The New Yorker was understandings, because we were told they weren't formal agreements. They were, you know, sort of understandings. And with the quid pro quo, I mean, the Pakistanis got something for agreeing. Essentially, the fact is that, and it's there, I can cite you chapter and verse, or even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, who's a decent guy, the new chairman, has spoken publicly. In one case, he told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he was testifying in May. Nobody paid attention to it. But he talked about 3 years of intensive work involving not only the Pentagon, but the Department of Energy in helping to make Pakistani the arsenal more secure. And we wish they did more. We think they could do even more. What happened is, again, after AFPAC, and you have to remember, the American policy was we wanted the Pakistanis to clean up the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban and al-Qaeda on their side, so that we could box everybody. We didn't want the Afghans, the Afghanistan Taliban, the Taliban who we've been fighting for 8 years, we didn't want them to go back and forth into Pakistan as they have been. And one of the concerns that we had was to get more Pakistani forces into the field. Most of them, a great many of the Pakistani divisions are tied up on the border with India. So you go to India and you say to Indians, we want you to pull some troops off the border, because if you do, the Pakistanis may pull some of their troops off the border and they can go fight the bad guys that we want them to fight. India said, you got to be kidding. We are looking at 80 or 100 nuclear warheads. I'm paraphrasing what I was told. I mean, I'm of course, the Indians didn't say it that way. But their message was, the Pakistani bombs are aimed at us, not at you. Make us happy. That's why things got more intense, maybe in late March and April. The president's AFPAC policy was enunciated in March. These agreements or understandings got pushed very hard in the spring, April being a big time, because if we could somehow get more access and make sure that the Pakistani arsenal was safe, learn more about it, also be able to tell the Pakistani military, the general in charge is a man named Kiani, a very decent man, get General Kiani to agree that if there was a mutiny and if there was some question about the security, you understand that the basic fear of a terrorist attack, the terrorist probably first target would not be us, it would be India, because that's how the longstanding enemy of many people in Pakistan. And so once we had these understandings in place, we could then go to the Indians and say, we've got you covered. Get troops off the border. They did move some troops, and Pakistan, the Pakistani army indeed has moved off the border, and there are more divisions in play. And once this agreement was, understanding was made, we began to funnel money into Pakistan
Let me just stop you for a second. So what you're saying is the understanding that the United States has with Pakistan about controlling Pakistan's nuclear weapons has a lot to do with an agreement with India to get its troops off the border so that Pakistan can pull its troops off the border and use them against the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
Which they are, which is exactly an outgrowth of the of President Obama's AFPAC policy, which is to get the Pakistan military more involved in fighting their own people, really. The Pashtuns are also Pakistanis.
And you said that there was a quid pro quo. So what did Pakistan get, as far as you were told?
It's more than that. I was told, and then I found it. What happened is, on the day after the president made his statement, April 29th, on the next day, Secretary of Defense Gates went before Congress, a Senate committee, and asked for $400 million as part of a $1.1 billion package of sort of additional aid, just sort of a sliding little money fund that's going to go into the Pakistani military to be controlled, not like most military funds with a joint State Department and Pentagon, but the Pentagon would handle it. And there wouldn't be there wouldn't be much information about how it was spent. And this money was appropriated by June. It went through the process very quickly. At least half of it was gone immediately into the Pakistani military. And at that point, General Kiani, the head of the Pakistani military, has long wanted more money from America to improve the quality of life, the housing and social programs for many of his Pakistani soldiers who are living some places in terrible conditions. I don't think the money is going to be misused, But I do know it's eventually going to be $1.1 billion in a special fund that was approved in a separate package. I got all the paper on it. It seems clear that part, I was told, and the evidence looks very strong, supports it strongly, that the Pakistani military was rewarded for its providing more access. The word my friend used in the inside was virtual access. And by the way, I learned about this from a different source than I usually deal with. And I went to the people I know well. There are people, obviously, that on the inside whose loyalty, by the way, is to the Constitution and not to necessarily to the president, which automatically makes them sort of different from what we've seen in the last 8 years anyway. And when I went to one and said, I understand there's been some new understandings or new deal-making, he got very angry, not at me, but he said, is there anything more stupid than here is a weapon system in Pakistan, the Holy Grail. It's the one system that the United States should keep away from because everybody in Pakistan doesn't trust us. They think we're too deeply involved. They think the government is too carries too much water for us, both the military and the civilian governments. And the idea that we would intervene to get more access or potentially more control or even some control over their weapons program would be just disastrous. And so what you're seeing right now, it's hard. There hasn't been much reporting in America for some strange reason about what's going on. But in the last, since my story came out at Monday of this week, there's been incredible chaos over there. It's all over the news, recriminations back and forth, and a lot of yamming and, you know, yada yada about it. Well, it's a huge issue.
Yeah, let me read what the Pakistan Foreign Ministry said about your article. They called it utterly misleading. You know, the idea that there was this understanding between the U.S. and Pakistan over securing Pakistan's nuclear weapons. They called your article utterly misleading and totally baseless, nothing more than a concoction to tarnish the image of Pakistan and create misgivings among its people. The ministry also said that you made several false and highly irresponsible claims by quoting anonymous and unverifiable sources, and that Pakistan's strategic assets are completely safe and secure. The multi-layered custodial controls which have been developed indigenously are as foolproof and effective as in any other nuclear weapon state. Pakistan, therefore, does not require any foreign assistance in this regard. That was a statement released by Pakistan's foreign ministry. And the United States also denies that there was any kind of, you know, deal or, you know, understanding.
The State Department did.
The State Department, yeah. They deny that there's a deal between U.S. and the U.S. and Pakistan on Pakistan's nuclear weapons. So do you want to respond to Pakistan's
I can give
statement?
You an easy response. Let me quote you from Admiral Mueller speaking to a group of reporters May 4th this year. This is a transcript. And don't ask me why this didn't make the news. But he was asked about Pakistan. And I quote him in the article, Admiral Mueller, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The admiral also spoke openly about the increased cooperation on nuclear security between the U.S. and Pakistan. Quote, these are direct quotes from the transcript, a DOD Pentagon transcript. I know what we've done over the last 3 years, specifically to both invest, assist, and I've watched them improve their security fairly dramatically. I've looked at this, you know, as hard as I can over a period of time. 17 days later, he told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, we've invested a significant amount of resources to the Department of Energy in the last several years to help Pakistan improve its controls on its arsenal. Quote, they still have to improve them, he said. So it's very clear, despite the denials, there's certainly been an ongoing American commitment, I think appropriately, to do what we can to make sure that the Pakistani arsenal is safe and inviolate, if you will. I think, and I can tell you right now, the major concern is that there's never been a serious concern about the Pakistani Taliban taking over the country. Pakistan is secular. Election after election proves that a small percentage of the people there, it's got a very vote for Islamists. It's got a strong middle class. The real concern is, as I said at the outset, of mutiny, of terrorism, some internal fifth columnist doing something. So. And you'll notice that the Pentagon has not been involved in these denials. I have, anyway, very carefully. And I've had, obviously, I have to tell you that without getting into it, because I've had extensive conversations with senior people that have been interesting, to put it mildly, in terms of basically not wanting to flatly deny something. It's to the credit, I think, of the Pentagon. I'm going to inspire them now to flatly deny it. I'm with this, but it's to their credit. And this is new. They have not gone in and just whipped us up. You know, the New Yorker always has a very serious and extensive fact-checking process. In fact, one of the fact-checkers, there were two who worked for 2 weeks on this because of one of them was from a family in Karachi, Pakistan, and she speaks, her native tongue is Urdu. So we really had some terrific stuff in terms of checking.
My guest is Seymour Hersh. His article in the current edition of The New Yorker is titled "Defending the Arsenal in an Unstable Pakistan. Can Nuclear Weapons Be Kept Safe?" We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Seymour Hersh. In the current edition of The New Yorker, he reports that the U.S. and the Pakistani military have been negotiating a secret understanding that would allow American units to provide added security to prevent Pakistan's nuclear weapons from getting in the hands of terrorists if there was a crisis. Now, let me ask you this. If there is an understanding between the U.S. and Pakistan that the U.S. would send special forces out to help Pakistan secure its nuclear weapons if necessary, why would you want to make that public, knowing, as you do, that this is, you know, this is very upsetting to people in Pakistan because much as they dislike India and fear India, a lot of them hate the U.S. even more. And for a lot of people, this is even more reason to distrust the United States because nuclear weapons are a kind of source of pride to a lot of people in Pakistan, and they feel they can handle it. They don't need the United States intervening. And the United States probably wants to keep this a secret, if in fact the understanding exists, because it's a military thing. I mean, you know, it's the kind of military plan that the military likes to keep secret. So what's in it to make it public? Like, why make it public?
Oh, there's a lot of reasons. For one thing, the fact of the matter is that I think these agreements aren't worth much. It was very clear that the Pakistanis had a different interpretation of what was going on than we did. We thought we reached some sort of understanding that was going to give us access in case of a crisis. We thought we were getting virtual data that was real, tangible. We were learning a great deal about the arsenal. From the Pakistani side, you got the strong sense that, are you kidding me? You think we'd really tell you the truth? I quote people in the article as saying that we'll never tell you the truth. No Pakistani general would tell you the truth about it. If you want to believe it's the truth, go ahead. But the reality is that, and I write very specifically about this, that there's a very strong chance that even some of the warheads themselves are not in the official count. As I quoted somebody, somebody said to me, they're in the tall grass along the runway, that the Pakistani army, because it doesn't like the civilian leadership, moves some weapons out of the count. So that we, no matter what we think we know, we don't know. So one strong reason for doing it is to get this point across that whatever agreements we make or understandings we have may not be worth nearly as much to us, to them, as they are to us. And the other reality is that for many Americans, any information we get on the Pakistani arsenal helps us target it, gives us more access to targeting. What do you think we're looking for in the last 10, 12 years? We and the Indians and perhaps even the Israelis, certainly even the Israelis, for sure. We've been looking very hard at finding a way to get those bombs out of there. We don't want, remember all this talk about the Islamic bomb that existed 2 decades ago when Pakistan first went nuclear? And you understand, of course, that we had looked away when Pakistan went nuclear because the Pakistanis were helping us fight the war against Russia in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen. And the price of that was for us to pretend that they weren't going nuclear. This was in the Reagan-Bush years. First Bush. And so that cynicism, of course, is another reason why the Pakistanis feel very misused by us. They understood that we understood that they were making a bomb. What's the fuss? The point is that if Pakistan and all of this dealing is not telling us everything there is to do and everything there is to know, withholding information, we on our hand are desperate to get any information we can in addition to what we have for targeting purposes, so we can plan more efficiently, perhaps going in and doing something to take those bombs or those triggers away from Pakistan. Because down deep, that's one of the basic things we'd love to do. We'd love to get those warheads. Therefore, you can argue that some wacky four-star might have an idea to go do something against Pakistan. Talking about this and raising it in public would make that pretty hard. It would be not successful, A, and B, any attempt to do anything to take a warhead away from Pakistan would make Pakistan our enemy immediately. And that we don't want either. The consequences of doing any overt act against Pakistan is very serious. So all of these things you're talking about were discussed internally. And the decision is that this is a story that will clear the air, that will have a purpose, which is to at least bring the whole issue out a little more into the sunlight. And I think that's always positive.
President Obama has escalated the drone program using unmanned planes to fire missiles at people who are suspected to be Al-Qaeda people in Pakistan. And this has been mostly in that northwest frontier territory. And in these drone missile attacks, there have been a lot of civilians who have been killed, as well as Al-Qaeda officials who have been killed, or Al-Qaeda leaders who have been killed. So do you have any inside information about how the drone program is affecting American-Pakistan relations?
Well, I quote President Musharraf in this article as saying that when the drones began at some point in late 2007, when he was still president, he wanted some control, and the Americans told him no. He's quite angry about this. He did say it, and he was asked that we not publish it, but I couldn't not publish something that was said in an interview. And he said he asked for permission to have access to the targeting and help and get some control, and the Americans said, no, it's our program. So then Musharraf, this incredible line he said to me, he said, well, I then asked if they would at least paint the Predators in the Pakistani Air Force colors so I wouldn't be shamed, and which says an awful lot about the relationship. It's not only Al-Qaeda they're going after. They're going after what they call the Pakistani Taliban. There has to be a distinction, because it's not clear that the Pakistani Taliban are as interested in international jihad or in taking over the country as we might think. There's a lot of reason to think they're just defenders of the turf, and they don't like in Waziristan, the strange world that they live in, the world of valleys and hilltops, and they don't like outsiders. Only thing I can tell you is it was a surprise to me that Obama he juiced the program. We're doing more of it. There's a lot of collateral damage. And so far, the military's response to that is not really to speak very much about the collateral damage. In Waziristan, for example, we're targeting men who might be Taliban. Only problem is we hit their homes, but the men and women live separately. But in Waziristan, as opposed to other places in Pakistan, the women's quarters are very next to the men's quarters. So our Predator missile, it's called the Hellfire, comes in and bam, everybody's gone. The American response has been to put out bids for a smaller missile that would go into the Predator, that would be a little more refined, so that if we hit a structure, we'd only kill the people in that room and not the people in the room next to it. Jane Mayer of The New Yorker wrote a very good piece on the whole issue, raising the moral issue, which hasn't been raised very much.
Seymour Hersh, thank you so much for talking with us.
Great.
Seymour Hersh's article in the current issue of The New Yorker is titled Defending the Arsenal. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews The Fantastic Mr. Fox, Wes Anderson's animated adaptation of a children's book by Roald Dahl. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Many of the late Roald Dahl's acclaimed books for young readers have been made into films, among them Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Matilda, and James and the Giant Peach. The latest book to reach the screen is The Fantastic Mr. Fox, the first animated film directed by Wes Anderson, who's best known for his features Rushmore and the Royal Tenenbaums. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Wes Anderson has a cult of worshippers, but I often find his films a little precious and mannered, a series of colorful dollhouses with people posed like puppets in the center of the frame. Now, in The Fantastic Mr. Fox, he's made an animated film in which the puppets are so vivid they seem like people. It's still the work of a filmmaker who likes to preen, a dandy, but it gels because the hero, the wily master thief Mr. Fox, is a dandy too. He even wears double-breasted suits inspired by Anderson's own showy wardrobe. And it gels because the animation fits the story. Anderson opted to use stop motion, the old-fashioned time-lapse animation that gave us King Kong and this year's sublime Coraline. So instead of the smooth, computerized feel of most modern animation, there's a slight jerkiness to the characters' movements that brings out their weight, their substance. I don't know how, but I felt as if the puppets themselves were taking pleasure in their own movements. Anderson's ultra-composed frames have never seemed so magically alive. The script by Anderson and Noah Baumbach embellishes Roald Dahl's brisk and cheerfully wicked kids' book, but the thrust is the same. Mr. Fox can't resist the challenge of stealing from his new neighbors, three nasty farmers named Bogus and Bunce and Bean, one fat, one short, one lean. He pulls off three splendid capers, but doesn't reckon on the vindictiveness of the farmers, especially the skeletal Bean. George Clooney does the voice of Mr. Fox, and at first I couldn't stop picturing his handsome mug. But Clooney is doing his best work in years. He even parodies his Ocean's 11 master thief. Like his director, Mr. Fox is wonderfully precise. As he assembles a team of animals to help him fight the farmers who've laid siege to his underground hideaway, he calls them by their English and Latin names.
All right, let's start planning. Who knows shorthand? Great. Linda, Lucha Lucha, you got some dry paper? Here we go. Mole, Talpa Europea, what do you got?
I can see in the dark?
That's incredible. We can use that, Linda.
Got it.
Rabbit, Orectologus Caniculus.
I'm fast.
You bet you are, Linda.
Got it.
Beaver, Castor Fiber.
I can chew through wood.
Amazing, Linda.
Got it.
Badger, Melis Melis.
Demolitions expert.
What? Since when?
Explosions, flames, burning things.
Demolitions expert. Okay, Linda.
Got it.
Weasel.
Mustela Navalas.
Stop yelling.
All right. Ha.
Woohoo.
All right, Ash. You get these little kids organized and put together some kind of KP unit or something to keep this sewer clean. It's good for morale.
Done. What's KP?
I think it means janitors.
After the Beach Boys on the soundtrack come Burl Ives, Mozart, the Rolling Stones, and Old Man River. Disjunctive, but then the whole movie's disjunctive, like the cultural bric-a-brac in Wes Anderson's teeming brain. You'll find your eyes roaming the frames and laughing at the flourishes and textures, at symmetry that's slightly unbalanced, so the screen is a seesaw. There are gags so ingenious they'd have made Bugs Bunny director Chuck Jones gasp. The actors bring their own kind of wit. Bill Murray as a militant badger, Michael Gambon as creepy Bean, Wally Wolodarski as Mr. Fox's nervous opossum sidekick, and best of all, Willem Dafoe as a hepcat knife-wielding rat security guard. Meryl Streep is the sharp, practical Mrs. Fox, who at one point slaps her reckless husband's face. You don't see stuff that serious in many animated family films. The Fantastic Mr. Fox is weighted down by a serious motif, one that runs through all Anderson's work. The son who desperately tries to forge a bond with his unappreciative father. Mr. Fox's boy, Ash, Jason Schwartzman, doesn't have his dad's athletic prowess, and he's hurt when Mr. Fox sees a chip off the old block in his cousin. The problem is Ash is a bit of a drag, and his efforts to prove himself are the movie's lone concession to formula. A small price to pay. With all the engineering behind The Fantastic Mr. Fox, it still feels handmade, as if the artists were in the room, manipulating everything on screen. When it ended, I wish they'd come out and take a bow. animation director Mark Gustafson, cinematographer Tristan Oliver, designer Nelson Lowry, the whole team, and of course, Wes Anderson, who for the first time has a right to preen.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air has a beautiful new addition to its family. Our producer, Sam Brigger, and his wife, Catriona, had a baby yesterday named Hazel Rose. We've seen a picture, and it's clear she's going to be as much of a charmer as her brother, Oliver. We can't wait to meet her. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lionsgate with the new movie Precious, presented by Oprah Winfrey and Tyler Perry, based on the novel Push by Sapphire, now playing in select theaters. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And from LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. This is NPR.
I was next to you and you were right there next to me. Then I said, go!
On the next Fresh Air, Rivers Cuomo, the lead singer and principal songwriter of the band Weezer. They've just released their seventh album. It's called Ratitude. Join us for the next Fresh Air.